Hello, I'm Dr. Albert Rizzo, Chief Medical Officer of the American Lung Association. Welcome to LungCast. This month's historical vignette, tied to our topic, takes us back over 1,000 years. Avicenna, who was born in the year 980, was a Persian polymath who is regarded as one of the most significant physicians, astronomers, thinkers, and writers of the Islamic Golden Age, typically felt to take place between the 8th and 14th centuries. Many physicians over the centuries respected Avicenna's clarity of communication and organization of his teachings, such that his preeminent medical text, the Canon of Medicine, was used at Europe's great medical schools well into the early modern period. The canon was subjected to ongoing critique over the centuries, especially by Renaissance instructors. Yet because Avicenna's text adhered to the practice and theories of medicine described in Greco-Roman texts, instructors used it to introduce their students to the basic principles of science. Lecturing in 1913, Sir William Osler, a Canadian physician and one of the four founding professors of Johns Hopkins Hospital and creator of the first residency program for specialty training of physicians, and who became the foremost clinical educator as well as renowned diagnostician in America, described Avicenna as the author of the most famous medical textbook ever written. Osler added that Avicenna, as a practitioner, was the prototype of the successful physician who was at the same time statesman, teacher, philosopher, and literary man. During the past two decades, personalized medicine and precision medicine have gained widespread attention. Choosing the appropriate medication for patients is based on the personal characteristics and individual differences, as noted in precision medicine. Surprisingly, the same concepts were cited by Avicenna, going back to as early as 1,000 years ago. Avicenna, in the fourth section of the first volume of his major encyclopedia, The Canon of Medicine, expressed several interesting points about choosing and prescribing medication pertaining to personalized medicine. He explicitly said, and quote, "Any medication will have different effects on different bodies, organs of a person, at two different points in time in one person's body, and in one organ at two different time points." He also described multiple factors that influence effectiveness of medications on the human body, one of the most important of them being the temperament of person and the target organ. Other factors included age, gender, habits, season, climate, occupation, physical strength, and physique. 10 major factors were examined by Avicenna and his followers to determine a person's temperament, including color of the face and body, skeletal structure, hair features, sleep-wake patterns, body excretion such as feces, urine, and sweat, and behavior, mental states, and mood. These factors could be considered the biomarkers of disease recognized as far back as the 10th century. Leapfrogging forward over 1,000 years, today we are going to discuss the ever-expanding world of biomarkers of the modern day, such as genetic mutations and plasma proteins, how they are applied to the precision treatment of cancers, in particular lung cancers. Now, let alone 1,000 years ago, the field of lung cancer treatment is one almost unfamiliar to what we knew just a decade ago, as precision medicine has evolved from a high aspiration to our golden standard, and yet there's ever greater leaps and bounds to be made. Equipped with refined screening methods, concise biomarkers, an armament of multi-stage immunotherapy agents, and even forefront artificial intelligence-supported pathology predictors, the near future of precision medicine is primed for the lung cancer care team. This great conversion of data, technology, and clinical research may be a little daunting for the average practitioner. So today we're hosting a crash course lesson on the bright future of lung cancer therapy with an expert who knows the ins and outs, Dr. Andrea Mazzocchi, co-founder and chief executive officer of Known Medicine, and currently a lecturer at Wake Forest University, joins LungCast to help us navigate the multifactorial innovations that go into precision lung cancer treatment. Interested to learn how epigenetics, machine learning, and the microbiome will help shape the future of oncology? Come learn on this newest episode of Lungcast. So that our listeners are on the same page as we are, can you define what you mean by precision medicine in cancer care today?
Yeah, so I think, all of us having the same understanding is incredibly important because we're hearing words like precision medicine, personalized medicine, all over the place and for all different things. So I think to really understand it, we have to think of it as using a patient's own tissue, their health records, or data surrounding them to then provide more patient-specific information that really helps inform or direct your healthcare decision. So using all of these different inputs, whether it's your own history, the actual tissue from a disease, using all of that and allowing your doctor to really interpret and understand what that could mean for your treatments or how your disease may progress. And so that may seem maybe obvious, but a lot of these new tools that are being developed are able to start looking at your tissue or your data in a more interesting way to really start predicting even better than maybe just one person being able to do so. And really the objective of all of these tools that are being created is to just make the best decisions for each person. And I think we can maybe think of it as it takes a village, really. And let's have all of these tools and all of these inputs so then we can make those best decisions. And I think when we think about our own health, we really want to have all of the best inputs to make that decision and not just one or two.
Well, I think that feeds into my next question. Now, we know that another popular term that has entered our lingo around cancer care is biomarkers. And these are sometimes assessed by blood draws, tissue biopsies, breath analysis, and so on. Maybe as part of explaining the role of biomarkers, can you also touch on the differences of things such as genetic biomarkers, epigenetic biomarkers, proteomics, et cetera?
Yeah, so I think broadly, biomarkers are just going to be something that can be measured. So if we think about maybe a substance, there's lots of different things in our blood, in our tissue, things that can be measured to really inform new decisions. And then we're also looking at features. And it might be a little bit more confusing to think about what is a feature. But if we're measuring something, you know, can we start measuring things like the size of something, not just things like, are there 10 cells or 20 cells? Can we actually measure how is that cell shaped or what is inside that cell? And so not just looking at a counting number, but really thinking about what could be unique about the tissues or something in that sample. And it's really as basic as that is biomarkers are these differences that we can measure in some way and then begin to relate back to disease progression, disease behavior, many different things. And so I think what's really interesting and important is that biomarkers can be used for kind of every point along the timeline of cancer, from the day or really detection of cancer all the way to are we able to predict recurrence after someone's in remission. And then, kind of diving into some of these biomarkers that you've mentioned. So I think the one that people are really most familiar with or maybe have heard the most about is going to be the genetic biomarkers. And so those we're thinking about most commonly genetic mutations. It can also be things like translocations. And these are actually copied or coded into your DNA. So we're able to look at the DNA and understand what mutations are there. And unfortunately, it's been recorded that there could be over 4,000 that really drive cancer. And so it's really important to know that those some of those are actually treatable. And so looking at that specifically, genetic biomarkers can be identified using either a blood sample or a tissue sample. So if you're using, have a pathology slide, a frozen sample, a paraffin embedded sample, all of those can be used to actually get that genetic mutation data. They're then in the lab isolating the cancer cells, able to do the DNA sequencing. And then many companies that are doing this or, kits that may be on the shelves for the oncologist are going to be looking at about 100 different mutations. And then these mutations can really drive potentially treatments that the patient would receive. And I'll dive into those a little bit more, but other biomarkers include things like epigenetic biomarkers. And this is going to be things that are not DNA encoded, but really influence how the cells will actually be responding. So it's not in the DNA itself, but does really impact how your cancer progresses. And so this will usually utilize something like the plasma from your blood or, you know, so part of a blood sample and is looking at either RNA or what is known as cell-free DNA. And so these biomarkers will really drive or help you understand the progression of a tumor and really help you keep an understanding of how the disease is progressing. And what I mean by that is maybe after treatment, you look at the epigenetic changes and then see if that drug is driving resistance or you can see response and then repeat this test throughout the process or throughout the treatment to really understand how the body's responding. And I think there's a lot of promise for tools like this to replace things like scans that you can't do as often and, you know, can only look at every few months. And if we can start to do some of this testing more frequently and then change routines or change treatments if needed. And they can also really be used for early diagnosis. Unfortunately, though, there's a lot of promise, and I think there's a much larger kind of bolus of mutations when we're looking at the genetic biomarkers. With epigenetic, there's only a small subset, especially for lung cancer, that we can really be looking at. Right now, there's really two that are identified, but two kind of epigenetic biomarkers. But I think this is a space that's really growing quickly, and we'll see a lot of promise, especially for looking at recurrence and the early detection. You also mentioned the proteomic biomarkers. And so with those, they're really unique in that we're not looking at the RNA or the DNA. We're just looking at what's in your blood. And so these are usually used after treatment. And we'll be then looking at just a few different protein components, far less common in comparison to the genetic and the epigenetic. And then I'd love to dive into phenotypic biomarkers as well, unless you have any questions to this point.
No, so far you touched on it, especially the part about using these biomarkers as potential screening tools for certain cancers.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that's with these blood tests, there's so much promise held in this early detection. Are we able to see any of these epigenetic changes? And I think this is really important too. We see that there's so many environmental factors, especially related to lung cancer. And, you know, there's one of the most common genetic mutations, EGFR, that's actually found, 50% of the patients with EGFR mutations are actually not smokers. And so that's something that's really interesting. Are we able to identify in these patients that we may not expect to develop lung cancer, are we able to identify sooner that there are some epigenetic changes that may be working to then allow this EGFR mutation to really take over? Or can we do some genetic testing earlier on using blood or plasma to start to indicate if there is a high risk group, maybe not in the lung cancer or the smoking groups that we can start to identify sooner. And then finally, for the biomarkers, thinking about phenotypic biomarkers. And so this, I think, is a really exciting and novel space where there's a lot of developing technology that's happening a little bit outside of the lab. And so this will be biomarkers that we start to think more about those features versus maybe counts or an identification of a mutation. And these are really being used for things like pathology. So we're starting to see more companies really spring up using those pathology slides. If they're already being annotated by the pathologist, can we then start connecting those with patients' EHR to really understand if there was anything in those images that would really predict how the patient would respond to treatment? And a lot of these technologies, this goes in with a lot of the ex vivo studies that we will touch on later, are really up and coming technologies. But when we think about biomarkers, it's important to think about these as well, because they are really looking at the cells. How are these cells actually behaving, and can we use them to predict in the future?
Just to concentrate a little bit more on the genetic mutations, it seems like every few months we are hearing about a new therapy for identified mutation. Can you discuss the different targeted mutations now available, especially in lung cancer, with known and available therapeutic interventions?
Yeah. So the first and really, I think the biggest or one that comes to mind for most is going to be EGFR. And so this is, from what I've seen, about 10% of non-small cell lung cancer patients will have an EGFR mutation. And then this is also the one that approximately 50% of the non-smoking population who has lung cancer will also have the EGFR mutation. And so I think that's a really interesting research problem that lots of people are really digging into. And I think we're also lucky in that there are quite a few treatments for EGFR. We're lucky in that there are 4 to 5 other treatments that can also be used for the EGFR positive patients. And so with these, there's a lot of opportunities to start using some of this genetic testing to start matching the patients with the stages as well as the mutations into what treatments will work best for them. And a lot of the tests that are being developed now are able to start indicating which of the treatments may work best. But again, lucky in that there are quite a few treatments for EGFR specifically. And then looking at KRAS, this is something that about 25% of patients with non-small cell will have. And then with treatments here, there aren't as many. I think we're looking at 2 to 4 treatments for KRAS. But again, there are opportunities there. And I think these, because they're so, you know, unfortunately, lung cancer affects so many patients, especially in comparison to other cancers, and that there's a lot of development around EGFR and KRAS treatments. And a lot of these can, as I said, be really dictated or driven by these genetic tests and are a great option for those patients who have been identified with mutations. A few other common mutations, or I should say less common, less than 5% of lung cancer patients will have them, are things like BRAF, HER2, MET, and then NTRK. And so with each of these, there are treatments that are available. However, in lung cancer, kind of less so in the FDA approved space. And really, because those percentages are small, we might be looking at thinking of off-label treatments for those. You know, not leaving out the other lung cancers, for squamous, there's about 50% of patients will have a key mutation either in FGFR1 or DDR2. Unfortunately, though, there aren't many developed treatments for those. And then I think, as many know, in small cell, there's no real key mutations identified for those. And because of that, we do have to look towards non-targeted treatments. The targeted treatments in general have really become quite popular in the last 5 years. And so I think the development there has been really phenomenal and gives quite a few opportunities, and really unable to identify these mutations without something like the genetic testing or an ex vivo kind of testing platform.
Are some of these targeted mutations used in concert with the tried and true standard, you know, cisplatin therapies that have been around for a couple of decades, I guess, at this point?
Yeah, definitely. And so I think for many of these treatments, patients are, or oncologists are going to be looking at not just the targeted treatment, but many are in parallel, or being treated in parallel with chemotherapies, and are also starting to be treated in parallel with immunotherapies. And so I think that's something that, you know, the targeted therapies are new, the immunotherapies are even newer, but there is still a lot of comfort in let's continue with the chemotherapies as well. And, you know, what's interesting and important to understand, too, is that these are all, after each treatment cycle, we should expect to be seeing epigenetic changes, and some of these mutational profiles will be changing. And so after a patient receives one genetic test, we shouldn't be assuming that it'll be their last genetic test. Things really do change over the course of time. And so that gives us a lot of hope and opportunity with some of these newer tests, where we can start to follow up and see, how is this patient changing, and how should this be changing their treatment plan, not just because of how they're physically responding, you know, maybe outwardly with symptoms to those treatments, but how has this cancer changed? And we need to think about the new treatment to really match that.
You touched on it briefly, but I wanted to switch gears a little bit and talk about the other big hope for effective therapeutic results is the immunotherapy and the different checkpoint inhibitors. Could you tell us about what's available out there and where you see the future going with this?
Yeah, so I think we've really just started, and it's such an exciting time, and there's a huge amount of promise in this space because we've really just started. And there's just about 5 treatments out for immunotherapies today. These are going to be for PD-1, PD-L1, and CTLA-4. And so I'll get into what each of those really mean. But I think broadly, just to understand what a checkpoint inhibitor or an immunotherapy really is. So what these are going to be inhibitors that are actually interacting with either the immune cells or T cells or the cancer cells. And what normally happens is that we have these receptors on cancer cells who are able to interact the immune cells and cancer cells together, or immune cells and healthy cells. All of the cells have these, and they interact with each other and say, either I'm a normal cell or I'm not a normal cell. Well, cancer cells, as we know, are very evolved and try to outsmart our bodies very often. And so these cancer cells will outsmart the immune cells and add on this additional receptor. And so this additional receptor now is able to attach to the immune cell, and it tells the immune cell, no, we're healthy, we're normal. don't worry about us, move along. And that's one of the biggest issues is now these immune cells aren't able to properly identify cancer cells. And because of that, it continues to progress. And so these inhibitors are able to either connect to the immune cell or the cancer cell and block that interaction between those two cells. And so now the immune cell is able to identify the cancer cell, but there's not a second checkpoint to say, no, we're normal. So now the immune cell knows this is not an okay cell, and we can go through really the next steps to attacking the cancer cell. And so that's why these are so exciting, because it gives a huge opportunity. You're really returning on your immune system. And so the PD-1 treatments are actually working directly with those immune cells and are attaching to the immune cells or T cells. The PD-L1 are working on inhibiting the cancer cell. And so the PD-L1 is, potentially safer in that we're putting this inhibitor on the cancer cell rather than the immune cell. And there is some risk when we put this inhibitor on the immune cell. That inhibitor is used for all of our healthy and normal cells as well. And so we do run the risk of having an autoimmune reaction when we have block off or inhibit that receptor on the immune cell. That said, when we do see these treatments working in patients, there's a really, really amazing response, and that patients who respond to these immunotherapies have increased survival and respond very quickly. Tumor size decreases pretty significantly and pretty quickly. But on the flip side, the risks are pretty big in this autoimmune reaction. Similarly, CTLA-4 works the same way, just using a different receptor versus the PD-1. But again, these are just the start of immunotherapies. And so we've identified in the scientific community two checkpoint inhibitors, and where else can we go? And I think there's a huge amount of promise and a lot of development still to be had, but these treatments are hugely helpful for the populations that are receiving them. And as I mentioned before, also oftentimes used either in combination with each other or in combination with chemotherapies or targeted therapies. So not often being treated alone, but are extremely helpful when they're added into the regimen.
Can you talk to us a little bit about the actual, what they call the microbiome of the cancer?
Yeah.
That's getting a lot of attention lately.
Yeah. So I think the microbiome is really interesting. And then thinking about this environment that the cells are really in is so complex. And this is something that I'm really passionate about, is what's happening around these cancer cells. And so how are they interacting with other cells? And there's so many other cells in the tumor. So we have a cancer cell, of course, but it didn't start as a cancer cell. It started as a normal, healthy cell. And we know in all of these tissues, there are other cell populations. So, you need these other support cells to create things like vasculature, really create the structure of tissue, and things we're also all familiar with, like collagen and laminin and fibronectin. And so all of these different components are really part of the bigger environment. And then we're able to start targeting these. And so there are treatments being developed around the microenvironment, and then also more specifically the microbiome. I'm less familiar with the microbiome of lung cancer, but I know we're starting to look at how all of these different environments are really changing and adapting. And this is also something similar to those epigenetics. It is changing from day one to month 6 to month 12 and really always evolving. And so it of course makes treatment and the treatment plans more challenging, but gives us more hope in that if we can recognize these things sooner, can we treat sooner and develop the best treatments for these earlier stage patients.
Thank you. There's certainly a lot of science that you've already discussed in just the last few minutes. But we know with a lot of new therapies and new science, there are sometimes hurdles to getting that knowledge to an actionable level across the country in an optimal way for patient care. My latest statistics showed that biomarker testing is somewhat in the maybe 70% of patients mm-hmm. nationally get it, where we know we'd like that to be up close to 100%.
Yeah.
And as highlighted during COVID-19, there are disparities that occur about medical knowledge and how it's put to use equitably across different populations. So can you just touch on your thinking about why it's taking so long for this to get penetration across the country and what we can do to help improve that?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of elements to making this something that's been really challenging to deploy nationally and then to really get that rate up to 100%. I think the first is really an understanding of how the tools can help. You know, we've been using chemotherapies for so many decades that to start to think about new targeted therapies can become overwhelming, and to really understand what those mutations are, what a targeted therapy means, and how do we build this into our new regimen can be quite challenging. And so I could understand if there is some kind of concern or pause when thinking about adopting them into the clinic. And I also think it's easy to see some of the more academic clinics that are really tied well or tied closely to research and are able to more easily have access to some of the cutting edge tools, knowledge, resources to understand what all of these new technologies are. And as they're coming onto the market rather quickly, you know, maybe impressively for the FDA and being able to get many of these new tools on quickly to help patients, it's pretty overwhelming to understand what means what and how they can help patients in different patient populations. And so I think education is a huge part, educating oncologists. And then I think we also see on the other side, there's a lot of education on the patient in the patient populations and them beginning to present these new tools to their oncologists, as we have all of the social media marketing, website marketing, TV marketing, and really trying to close the gap between the patient population, the oncologist, and then what the science and what the tools really mean and how they can really be used. And so I think education is a huge part, as well as creating and really supporting systems to allow for the tools to be deployed. And, you know, this means, unfortunately, some, I think, hospitals may not have infrastructure to really support some of the new either systems that need to be set up in the hospital to run some of these tests, or the bandwidth to have clinical coordinators and other staff to really be able to deploy the test in-house and then, you know, maybe fill a kit and send it out. And so it's not just looking at the oncologist or the patients, but really the infrastructure that allows for these new tools to be adopted. As I said, it's happening. These tools are coming out fast. And I think it's really challenging, not just things like the EHR or coding systems for insurance, but really the infrastructure within a hospital to stay up to date and be able to onboard these things that are really requiring new skills, new tools, new thoughts around helping patients.
I think in keeping with your discussion about the infrastructure, I know when we look at best practices, there is a concern about the delay in diagnosis, the delay mm-hmm. in getting targeted mutations identified yep. from the time of diagnosis to treatment. Can you talk about how important it is to get that therapy started as soon as possible in many of yeah. these situations?
Yeah, I think this is an incredibly important point and something that it can really create some tension between the test and needing to treat patients. And so for a genetics test, the companies that have these genetic tests have been working quite hard to reduce the time. I think maybe a year or two ago, it was anywhere from 6 to 8 weeks was that genetic test turnaround time. Now I'm hearing more of 3 to 6 weeks. There's a new test that they're saying the turnaround's 1 week. And so there is a lot of improvement on the test side. However, that still is a delay. And so there is this conflict of let's treat with maybe a chemo, hold off on those targeted treatments until we hear back if there's even an option for targeted treatment. A concern there, though, is that we do expect that there will be some epigenetic or genetic changes with treatment. And so if we're seeing one key mutation at day one or really day zero, but we don't actually find out about it for 3 weeks, they receive a treatment between day zero and 3 weeks. How has that changed? And has it changed enough that mutation isn't going to be the right treatment anymore? And I don't think that there is a clear answer for, you know, how should we, or what's the best way to address it? But I think what is being done is patients receiving that treatment if they need to immediately, and then hoping that the genetic testing is still appropriate. And I think in many cases it will be, but that, you know, really lends to how important it is that we can get some of these faster turnaround tests so we can help patients and really fit into that treatable schedule. And then also be able to test many times to stay up to date on how they should be treated.
One of the main advocacy issues the Lung Association strives to bring across is the fact that once therapies are proven and worthwhile, are they able to be afforded, covered, and regulated in a manner that makes it equal across the board? So do you see the insurance companies and regulatory agencies being a hurdle anywhere along the way here?
Yeah, I think definitely. I think there's a lot of conflict, with the drug developer, the pharma companies that are developing the drugs, the companies that are developing these biomarker tools, and the oncologist. And we hope that everybody wants the best for the patient. I think there's many cases where the biomarkers can indicate that a treatment or a drug should be used that may not be in necessarily the insurance company's best interest, and then puts the oncologist in a place in which they have to make decisions based on both the insurance company's willingness as well as the willingness or what the tools are indicating. And so I think when it comes to treatment, that puts them in a very challenging position. And even to get to that position, I think can be challenging because not every insurance is going to be covering these biomarker tests. Not every insurance company, I think maybe few insurance companies will be covering many genetics tests or many biomarkers tests, allowing them to be done, over the entire timeline of a patient's cancer journey. And so there is quite a bit of conflict. And, what if these biomarkers are pointing to an off-label treatment or a more expensive treatment? And then in my experience with these biomarker companies, it's never just presenting one treatment. There's always, well, the patient may have four mutations. Maybe they have an ALK rearrangement and an EGFR mutation. And so which one are you going to treat? And it can put those decisions into the oncologist's hands, making those decisions then based on the insurance as well. So though we hope that all of these tools are really helping patients, I think it does create many complications that just hasn't been enough time or maybe enough energy put towards them to really sort out and ensure that the patient really is getting the best treatment that the tools are really helping point to.
Great. You mentioned early on that there are some newer technologies you wanted to tell us about. Could you please go into that a bit?
Yeah. So I think, and this is something that I'm incredibly focused on, interested in, have been interested in for quite a long time, is these ex vivo cell cultures and starting to think about taking the experiment really out of the patient. And so with so many of these biomarker tests, we are relying on electronic health record data to really tie something like a mutation with the best treatment for a mutation. And these are getting better, but we're still putting this experiment into a patient. And I think EGFR is a great example. So there's 5 EGFR treatments. Even if a genetic test points to EGFR as your mutation, which treatment should you receive? It still can be fairly unclear. And so you're really using population statistics at that point and a best guess to determine the treatment you should be receiving. Your oncologist is making that decision. And so a lot of these ex vivo cell culture, companies, products, tools are really focused on taking the patient's cells either from a tissue biopsy, a tissue resection, maybe a blood sample, depending on how the assay is built out, and starting to look at if we can treat this patient and these cells with tens, dozens, hundreds of different treatments, can we observe how those cells will respond and then give that feedback back to the oncologist directly? And so this is really powerful because now, as I said, the experiment is out of the patient into a plate or something like that. And we can really see how are they responding mechanistically, understanding how these chemotherapies, targeted therapies, or immunotherapies will work for that specific patient. And not leaving the population statistics too far behind, we can then also use machine learning to, pull out features from these cells and then also start to relate them to how do the patients really respond and how have patients historically responded and really start to make some of these inferences that we as people can't obviously make and then really extracting some of these features from images of cells to better understand how they're behaving, how they're responding to treatments, to not just help patients today, but really help patients as we're able to do things like develop drugs based on our understanding and really help patients 10 years down the road, if not further. So I think there's a lot of power there. And I think it's a great time to point out too, if I haven't already, that these biomarker tests, the ex vivo, the genetic, all of them are really powerful alone. But I think the more that we're able to bring them together, all of these data points, though overwhelming, can really create a lot of power for treatment decisions. And, you know, if we're able to identify, yes, there's an EGFR mutation, so then in an ex vivo culture, we need to prioritize EGFR treatments and really understand which one might be the best, or are they not working? I think there's a lot, quite a bit of opportunity for synergy between these tools. And in particular with late stage patients, where every treatment they receive is, you know, we hope not putting them further away from recovery, but in many cases can be. And so can we start to use some of these new technologies and tied with things like machine learning to really understand how to best treat these people who today, the, you know, every day that passes, it becomes more worrisome.
Well, your knowledge and enthusiasm about this topic has come through very clearly here. Is there anything you'd like to mention in addition?
No, I think that this really has covered it, and that we need to continue developing all of these different biomarkers tools. And I think the development happening in research labs, companies, you know, with insurance companies, having the education of oncologists and patients, all of these things together is, I think we're going to see a really, really significant change in the next 5 years. And I hope that in less than 5 years, but I could see in 5 years, us all looking back and wondering what happened 10 years ago and why the treatments were the way they were. And I'm really excited for where we are today and where we're going in cancer care.
Thank you very much for the time today.
Yeah, thank you. I really appreciate being on.
Thank you again to Dr. Mazzocchi for guiding us through these exciting prospects of lung cancer care innovation. So many long sought after oncologic treatment capabilities are on the precipice of mass availability and implementation. Every next day seems a little brighter for lung cancer care. If you enjoyed this interview on lung cancer precision medicine, be sure to check out previous LungCast episodes, including our discussion on lung cancer interception with Drs. Avi Spira and Stephen Dubinet, available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and other major podcast platforms. For additional news and insights into respiratory health, be sure to visit us at hcplive.com and lung.org. Until next month, I'm Dr. Albert Rizzo, reminding you that if you can't breathe, nothing else matters, so just take it one breath at a time.